Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Nailers Natter. This week with Jonathan Klukas. Jonathan is the head teacher of Leighton Primary School in Blackpool, and I'm personally very fortunate to work quite closely with Jonathan and the Leighton staff in our work with the Blackpool Research School. So a little bit of context for this interview. So listeners may be aware of the new book from Ross Morrison McGill of Teacher Toolkit, and it's called Just Great Teaching. Now, Leighton Primary School have been featured in this new book as one of the school case studies. And the reason for this is that outcomes at Leighton Primary School have been consistently excellent and pupils achieve extremely well, and there are no significant gaps between groups of students, which, if you consider the context in terms of the proportion of disadvantaged students, is way above the national average, and 50% of children are pupil premium at the school. So there's a fantastic positive culture involved in developing and maintaining these high standards, and I can personally testify to the hard work and dedication of all the staff that work there. So in this podcast, and it's a wide-ranging interview in a phrase stolen from Greg Barton, but we discuss, amongst other things, responsive teaching, dialogic teaching, modelling, and the use of technology as a tool to support responsive teaching. And we also have our regular Teacher Development Trust section, which I've mixed things up a little bit, and I've moved that to the beginning of the podcast, so that will come up straight after this gentle introduction. So, fire up the ignition, put on the running shoes, or just sit back and relax for another Nailers Natter, this week with Jonathan Klukas.
Welcome to Nailers Natter, musings on evidence-based teaching and professional learning. Follow us on Twitter at PNA 1977.
Hello, this is Bethan Hindley, School Programme Leader at the Teacher Development Trust. I've just finished sending out certificates for our recent cohort of very impressive TDT associates who've been working really hard over the last year to develop a professional learning portfolio. Now, there's lots of great work to highlight from these portfolios, and I want to use this week's segment to share some work from one associate who's a head teacher in Leicestershire. I'm going to talk about one aspect of their portfolio, which is the Professional Learning Transformation Plan, and in this case, the associate focused on CPD planning across a trust of 10 primary schools. So first, having carried out a review of the trust's culture, processes and leadership of CPD, this head teacher wanted to ensure that all aspects of the planning, brokering and evaluating of impact of CPD were brought together with a commitment of doing it properly. There are various different aspects to this head teacher's plan, but one part involves distributing the leadership of CPD across the trust and creating a network of new research-informed professional learning leaders who will oversee the evaluation of the impact of CPD and research-informed practice in their schools. They'll also come together regularly to share and inform trust-wide planning. These leaders will work in the schools with SLT and staff, but also with the MAT and teaching school to add context and detail to larger CPD plans, as they'll be evaluating and feeding back what is needed in their individual schools. The plan carefully outlines how the MAT will invest in improving these new leaders' understanding of evaluating and leading CPD in their schools. They'll be key in creating momentum beyond the end of any training that takes place in the school and ensuring that new learning becomes embedded in college practice, as well as creating professional learning plans for their schools. While we're working with participants on the CPD leadership course, we asked them to share a first draft of their plans with a senior colleague and an external expert who knows the school context well in order to get critical feedback on their plan. We've worked with a large number of leaders who make fantastic plans, but then struggle to get the buy-in of colleagues. And we found that this step is really crucial to gaining the support of these colleagues. So in this associate's case, the trust CEO provided critical feedback on the head teacher's plan, which they then acted on by creating a feedback timetable for the network of leaders. The opportunity for the professional learning leaders to regularly feedback to the school and trust leaders will ensure that internal accountability is present and will prevent a false start by ensuring that all schools are accessing the relevant information and support. It's really fantastic to see how this head teacher has combined the research on professional development and change management and used this to create a network of leaders within their trust, and we're excited to continue working with them. If you'd like to hear more about the TDT Associate Qualification in CPD Leadership, please visit tdtrust.org/training.
Hello everyone, you are listening to my dad on the podcast Nailers Natter.
Follow him on Twitter at PNA1977.
Okay, so hello Jonathan and welcome to the podcast.
Hi Phil.
And this is the first one that I've ever done live, so I'm a little bit nervous now as I'm...
You're the only one. There's two of us.
Yeah, absolutely. So usually it's Skype recorded audio.
Okay.
And I can sit here scribbling away at answers. But yeah, we're currently sat in Jonathan's office on a sunny Friday the 13th in Blackpool. Brilliant. So we're going to start with our usual journey to this point question. So we just tell listeners a little bit about your journey to this point and how you became head teacher of Leighton Primary School.
Okay. Now that's something you don't really think about, isn't it? It's something you don't... Graduated in 1996, having done some sort of non-teaching jobs before university, of working in a bank and being a lab technician and mad scientist and so on, badly. I was terrible at all of those. Went to teacher training college and graduated in 96, the year after the national curriculum came out and the year before the national strategies were piloted. So I had 2 years, basically, of teaching of, you know, the old-fashioned sort of head teacher puts you in a classroom and leaves you to it, and then you see them at Christmas occasionally. So everything going okay? So sort of in key stage one and key stage two, I had two stints. Then I moved to Blackpool, and I've been teaching in Blackpool since 1998. Initially as a teacher at Mearside Primary School in year six for 5 years. Then as a consultant across Blackpool, a teaching and learning consultant with a specialism in numeracy, and as a deputy head at King Craig, which is a small one-form entry school in the north of Blackpool. And the head teacher left after 2 years and I became head. And then from there, after 8 years there, I became head here. I suppose the thing that we've done at every single school is some of the work that I've been fortunate to be involved in and been able to do has raised standards significantly. So the children, disadvantaged children in Blackpool and advantaged children in Blackpool, because there's a wide demographic, have been able to develop skills with some of the work that we do that they perhaps wouldn't have had. And that to me is the motivation behind why we do what we do, is to enable the children to become much, much better. And that's a teaching sort of motivation, isn't it, as opposed to personal ones. So I've been here 8 years. It's a three-form entry school, a large primary school, and that involved quite a lot of change. That was the biggest change and the hardest challenge, I think, of my career, because you're going from a small primary school with seven classes where you can just pop in every class and to managing a large group of children and a huge amount of staff, over 70 staff. You've got to have systems and procedures in place and so on and so forth. So that's basically how I've arrived here at the age of 48, grand old age, and the work that we're doing at this moment in time.
I was just going to cut in there and say to listeners, this is a visual podcast. There's no way that Jonathan can be 48. If listeners can see, we'll do the pictures at the end and compare and contrast, because I'm trying to pretend I'm early 40s, although I'm sort of dragging that a little bit now.
And a grandparent.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
But I became a grandparent a couple of years ago. So and people, I did say, and somebody said to me the other day, no. And I said, I know you're lying. I know you're telling the truth.
Brilliant.
Had perhaps been a little bit neglected in terms of teaching and learning, in terms of staff knowledge and staff development, in terms of curriculum content, as well as how to get that across. And the school was all right. But that didn't mean necessarily that the staff didn't have lots of potential. There were lots of staff who did have lots of potential. So the first thing we had to develop was teacher knowledge of learning, because there was a lack of understanding of learning and there was a lot of understanding as to a scheme. So they'd had a huge scheme-led approach to the vast majority of subjects. Now, if you are given a scheme of work, and I do have this conversation with secondary colleagues quite a lot,
yeah.
if you are given the content to deliver, content is the enemy of innovation, and it's the enemy of development, and sometimes it can be the enemy of learning. So you are focused on the only thing that teachers become in control of is how they deliver that content, as opposed to what the content might be, how they might shape it, how they might change it. So you stop thinking about how layers of understanding are built up. You just think, well, I've got to deliver this stuff. Now, underneath all that is a whole level of a frame of reference or a schemata that actually needs exploring before the stuff is delivered. So for a whole year, we spent developing knowledge around assessment for learning. So that's virtually all I did for the first year. As a result of that, and therefore, some of the teachers who were the early adopters began to change the content. And the content change was a result of understanding that actually there are techniques that you can use to get better information from children. So I suppose what, you know, Dylan Williams is one of my, you know, read him a lot, he's a real advocate of his work. But what he's essentially saying is, here are some ways you can get information from children about where they are and what they know. That's basically what it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So here are lots of ways to get information. So first of all, you've got to work on what techniques you can use to get that information from. The second thing is, you've then got to process that information. So if you're going in for an operation, in some ways teachers' jobs are harder than surgeons' jobs. Okay. If you're going in for an operation, you've had an MRI scan, you've had an X-ray, they know exactly what's wrong with you, and they have a technique to put it right, and they operate on one person at once.
Yeah.
All right. Teachers cannot see any of those things. There's nothing that can actually tell you what is inside a child's head. There's no scan that says they know this but they don't know that, and you're dealing with 30 schemata at the same time. So in other words, there's got to be some sort of format to the delivery, but you've got to get information. So the first thing was, how am I going to get this information out of children? Because if I'm just delivering stuff, the information coming from children doesn't matter. I just have to deliver this stuff. That's the first thing we had to come away from. The second thing was, what am I going to do with all that information now I've got it? Because actually you can get all that information, but if you don't do the right stuff with it, or use the right techniques, or develop the right responses to it, or provide the right feedback from it, then the information goes nowhere. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So for a year we worked on getting that information. For probably a whole other year we worked on ways in which you can deal with that information, how to respond to it.
Yeah.
And then how to actually change work because of it.
Yeah.
So the first thing to get that information across, you can't just do staff meetings, because that's like going to, because you go to staff meetings, look, here's something, that's like going to a piano recital every week to listen to somebody play the piano. It's very nice, but if you're learning the piano, watching somebody play the piano will have a very limited impact on your ability to get any better. So the staff meeting is a bit like the, where are we up to, how are we doing, what are we going to go next? Actually, to get involved in teachers and change habits, which is what you are, if you're a head teacher, I see my role, a huge part of my role, the main part of my role is changing teacher habits, because everyone can get a little bit better. You've got to be in the planning stage and you've got to be in the classroom. Okay, so one of the first things I did was teachers were going home for PPA. So they all had to come together in order to be able to plan together, and also get a member of SLT in there to support that planning process and get the teachers thinking regularly about the things that we wanted them to think about. So that was one of the first organisational changes. Lots more questioning, lots less prescriptive. So instead of, this is stuff to do, what are you going to do? Why are you going to do that? What's thinking behind that? Where are the children up to in that? What's the purpose of doing it? So the why became more important than the what. Teachers are very focused on what, because they've got a busy lives. They're teaching 20-odd hours a week and they've got stuff to deliver. So teachers focus on what they do, not necessarily why they're doing it. And because it's on the syllabus or because it's in the scheme of work is not a satisfactory answer from my point of view, or because it says this, but we have to do it, okay?
I was just thinking while you were talking then, in terms of, I spoke to Mark McCourt about this conveyor belt curriculum followed by assessments. So I think back, you know, 10, 15 years ago, when, well, I've got to deliver the curriculum. I've got to get through the curriculum as quickly as I can. Then I've got to this assessment at the end of it. And when I get to the assessment, I record the results and then carry on delivering the curriculum. And what you were talking about there in terms of how you respond to it, that seems to be something that the profession is moving towards, and the stuff that we're getting involved with in terms of...
Well, the assessment should come first.
Yeah.
Do you design a driving course that everybody has to do, whether you're that lady off Britain's Worst Drivers, if I remember in that blue larder, or you're Lewis Hamilton?
Yeah.
Because the scheme of work is only that. What you're saying is, whether you're Lewis Hamilton or the lady off that car,
Maureen,
whether you're Maureen or Lewis Hamilton, everybody's got to do the same course.
Yeah.
Well, that's ludicrous, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, actually, in an average classroom that is unstreamed in a primary school, you have that range of ability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's ridiculous. The assessment has to come first.
Yeah.
And then understanding what to do with that. To do that, you have to understand learning. So there's lots of models and theories of learning, but what we settled on was basically a schemata-led approach. We looked at approaches to learning. How do people learn? So Guy Claxton's done huge amounts of research on how anybody will learn, whether you're 5 or 50 or 90. You know, so there are certain skills involved. That then became a driving focus in feedback, as did growth mindset work. Mm. So the bottom line is you can read lots about growth mindset, but actually, if we can boil it down to, I can always get better.
Yeah.
You can boil it down to that, and I can be open-minded about getting better. Yeah. That's the culture you've got to establish. So if that's the culture for children, how do you then establish that for teachers? Because some teachers, you know, traditionally, I am the stand at the front, I deliver knowledge, you are the fountain of knowledge, I will deliver my knowledge to you, you will grasp it. Well, that's a very old-fashioned way of working, isn't it? And the profession's moving away from that now. But there was quite a bit of that. If you're using a scheme-led approach for a long period of time, you can slip into that trap, don't you?
Yeah.
So how do you move from... The vision for me was always, how do I get 31 teachers and 31 learners in a classroom? Remember, 1992, Three Wise Men report came out. This is for some of your listeners who may be around about my age.
Of which there are many, I'm sure.
So it'd be interesting to see, who were the three wise men, Phil? I'm going to test you. Who were the three wise men in the 1992 report? Three men who you would probably never see in a room ever again.
Bearing in mind I was in year 10 in 1992. Which is, that's not rare that I can come across as being young, is it? But it's to say I didn't leave school until 1993, so I'm a bit stumped, actually. To be
all right, the three wise men report.
I might know who they are if you tell me.
All right, you will know all of them. One was Chris Westhead.
Woodhead.
Chris Woodhead.
Yeah, I remember him.
The second, who you would not put with Chris Woodhead, was the writer of the Cambridge Review and writer of Dialogical Teaching, was Robin Alexander.
Robin Alexander, yeah.
All right. And the third was Jim Rose.
Right.
Okay, so they produced a report at that time, one of which said people aren't subject, you know, people don't know enough stuff in primary schools, and a whole host of other things. Then Chris Woodhead obviously went on to be head of Ofsted and upset a lot of people, you know. But that, the crux of that was, teachers need to know more stuff. As a result of that, 5 years later, the strategies came out, and they told people what to do. So you had, by the time I came here, you probably had 14 years of people being told what to do and not thinking for necessarily enough for themselves. So you've got to get away from that, and to do that, you've got to give people more skills.
Mm.
And people had stopped thinking about learning and started thinking about teaching. Well, then you've got a whole generation of teachers in over 20 years who've just thought about delivery and not learning. So we've de-skilled ourselves in some ways, I think, and we've allowed that de-skilling to happen, and we've allowed people to tell us what to do, whereas actually, really interesting, Dilla William on the work you do is he says teachers are semi-professionals rather than professionals, doesn't he? He says... And he said, and again, research is the right way to go, but research depends upon your frame of reference.
Always.
Always.
I'm really interested, I'm just thinking there about your driving school analogy, that works really well, if I reflect on practice from, again, about 10, 15 years ago. So, you know, you give your Maureen driving school example. So the way I would teach was, right, there's a curriculum for driving, so I'm going to teach you all of these different bits, you get to the assessment, you fail, right, doesn't matter, we're going on the motorway now. And then, doesn't matter, well, you still fail, but I'm going to take you Formula One.
Yeah.
And there was no actual, and you've talked about responsive teaching, there was no going back to, and discovering what it is that's stopping you from being able to do this and how we tailor the teaching to be able to make sure that you can get towards this, because we were constantly concerned about covering the curriculum.
And there's ways in which you can... A, the understanding of a concept is built up upon several layers. So if you're going to understand how to drive a car, for example, on a car park, you need to understand where the clutch, the accelerator and the brake are. You need to know where the indicators were. You need to know that the steering wheel does this. You need to work out the biting point. Mm. And then you can drive in a car park. But that's a useless skill, because nobody goes to a car park and drives around. So you have to work out, well, now I've mastered these, I now need to apply it on a road. Mm. And once I've applied it on a road, I need to apply it on a motorway. And once I can apply it on the motorway, I can apply it in snow, in wind. I can even go to Italy and drive in Italy.
Which I have
at great personal risk. So you've actually got to build up the skills, and teachers need to be adept at diagnosing where and that. So you've got the what, how am I going to find that information out? Mm. Then you've got the what am I going to do with the information? Then you've got the growth mindset, and then comes the feedback stuff. Mm. Now, I'm sure loads of your listeners are familiar with all sorts of feedback, and for us the bottom line was, Stop praising children ineffectually.
Yeah.
Great, super smart. It's I call it the bullseye analogy, for those of us who can remember.
This bullseye is great, isn't it? The number of 80s references we can get to one podcast.
Super smashing great.
Accrington's finest.
Yeah.
The Jim Bowen.
So you will remember Jim Bowen.
Well, from many different... I mean, I believe, in a kind of link here, Jim Bowen was a teacher in Accrington.
Was he?
I'm pretty sure that's true. Obviously, feel free to email and tweet to correct me, but having been a pupil in Accrington, the legend was that he had been a teacher in Accrington at around about the same time that maybe I was at school.
So maybe the super smashing great analogy came from that.
Maybe.
But teachers are very good at super smashing great. Good, you've answered a question. Yep. And really, that's an emotional response from a teacher. Mm. It's an emotional response to say, well, good, I have delivered information. You have relayed that information back to me. Therefore, I am a good teacher. Therefore, I will praise you for just answering the question that you already knew the answer to before I even asked it.
Yeah. Okay. And questioning, there's that seamless link into dialogic teaching. Now, you mentioned Robin Alexander before, in terms of we are doing disciplined inquiry this year at St Mary's.
Right.
So for the first time, I'm going to be involved in doing that. I've done it in a lot of other schools, but in terms of our own school, I'm doing it this time. And that's going to be my focus in terms of dialogical questioning, because I am, a reflective practitioner, in terms of I know this is really my weak area. I am one of those super smashing great teachers who looks for the answer that I'm basically giving you in every question that I ask. And I'm really being careful to use questions diagnostically and then to ask follow-up questions based on the information that I'm getting, because my year nine at Middlesex, which is mainly boys, are quite good at kind of second-guessing what I want them to say and guessing answers so that the spotlight goes away from. So tell us a little bit about sort of your journey in terms of reading that book and how you've applied that in your own practice and maybe across the school.
Well, the key was always, once you got that, all those things in place, and teachers are asking much better questions, the key questions a teacher asks are the supplementary questions, not the first one. Mm. And once you get away from that guess what's in my head type question, all right, and start moving towards more open questions, then I started wondering, what could happen if the children could ask these questions? Mm. You know, if they have opportunities to come up and develop their thinking. What if we got to a stage where we didn't necessarily always tell children whether they were right or not? Mm. Where actually questions develop more questions. Some questions there are not a wrong or right answer to. So, for example, you're doing World War II in history. Is war ever the right thing to do? There is no answer to that, isn't there? There is no one right answer. There are answers, but there is no one right answer.
Yeah.
Can war ever be justified? You know, if you're doing something like geography, for example, is Hurricane Dorian a direct result of man's and woman's activity?
Well, it is if you involve a Sharpie.
Yeah.
I may have to remove that for legal reasons.
I may have to extend the range of the hurricane to Alabama. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, really.
So it's about saying, well, hang on, what are kids going to... And then, only then, because I know that people are interested in the use of technology and so much in our school, did we then start using technology in order to develop that. So the technology came in after all that work had been done. Mm. And when people come to see us about technology and iPads and stuff, they say, what do I do with them? Well, you know, we didn't really invest heavily in that until about 4 years in, and people have got those skills, because otherwise you run the risk of the what app do I get?
Yeah.
Well, the only app you need is the teacher. And all those things that you can do with an iPad, you can probably do without an iPad. What the iPad does is it enables instant, correct feedback. Interestingly, we've just got rid of the word marking from our vocabulary.
Mm.
Okay, because every question you ask is an opportunity to provide feedback to students. Every single one. So feedback via marking is of limited value. Unless children actually get to respond to it, and it becomes a two-way process. That's the only, because then otherwise you're just fixing up work. Marking for years has been focused on fixing up work instead of developing the learner. So what have we focused on developing the learner? What have we asked questions that were more open that children could then develop the ability to ask? Because if we're asking enough of the right questions, children can work out the questions to ask.
Yeah.
And what if we use technology to give them the platform to facilitate learning in the classroom? All right. And what if we encourage dialogical teaching or discussion or questioning themselves in order for them to be able to do that? So the turning point to turn it from really good to extremely good for some of our teachers was when they did less and the children did more. Because after all, you know, you're there to help children learn, not necessarily to teach them a barrel load of stuff. And also we've got clearly identified skills. So you can say, well, we're teaching them to ask questions. Well, what are the skills that go into doing that? Well, we're teaching them to be creative. Well, actually, creativity is not one skill. It is a whole host of skills which need to be disciplined. But once you teach those skills, as a result, creativity becomes better. Just like the teaching and learning, as a result of focus, we didn't focus on SATs results or outcomes, but as a result of focusing on all those things, value added went and SATs results went through the roof. That's not the be-all and end-all, and there's lots more important stuff than that. But that happened as a result. If you focus on the results, you know, you'll move the results, but not by very much. You focus on what and why, as a result, better things will happen. Absolutely. So real focus on that became about 2 to 3 years ago. And initially, here's the point, teachers got worse.
Mm.
I'm not saying we had really good teachers whose teaching wasn't as good because they didn't know when, they did know how to do it. But as Dylan Williams says, and the question in teaching isn't what works, it's under what conditions it works.
Yeah.
So what they were doing were learning and developing the best ways and the best times and the best appropriate times to do it.
I mean, you mentioned technology there, and wearing my other hat in terms of research school, we launched our digital technologies. We do launches for all of our guidance reports, and we purposely chose Leighton to come to for that, for exactly the reasons that you talked about. So people, you know, it's very divisive as a debate, particularly on Twitter, around digital technology, and you see people that are quite evangelical about the use of technology, and then people that are, and increasingly, I said this on last week's podcast, but increasingly the newer teachers are almost becoming evangelical about not using it. Perhaps in the same way that the, you know, vinyl's on the way back and things like that. It's almost the response to too much technology is to take it away. But what you've done with it is, you said there, you've done 3 or 4 years of getting the questioning right, and then you've used this as a tool for that. So just, you know, for listeners that are thinking about technology, you said it's not the what, it's the why, in terms of why do you need it. So how did you come to that decision? And then how do you go about using technology in your classrooms at Leighton? Big question.
First thing is, for me, you've got to work out that what's going to happen. What's our curriculum very much demonstrates who you are and what you believe in as a school, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So therefore, let's look at the children we are currently teaching. Okay, they're going to have about 14 jobs. The average person has 14 jobs by the time they're 38. That's gig economy.
I think I've got four now.
Contracts. Yeah, exactly. But it's 14 jobs by the time, yeah. 38. They're using the worst piece of technology they'll ever use. Facebook is the biggest country on the planet. 2.2 billion current users.
Wow.
All right. And 2.5 billion internet devices currently in use in the world. All of which are the worst devices that people will ever use. Mm. Right. So 10 years ago, nobody knew how to work a smartphone, or really, or maybe a bit longer than that, because the iPhone's been out a while, but most people didn't have them. 20 years ago, nobody wanted to be a smartphone developer or an app developer, because the technologies in which they were going to, you know, put those apps didn't exist. Mm. So you've got to remember that the jobs that our children are going to do don't exist anymore. The amount of information in the world is doubling every 2 years currently. So that if you do a university course that's 4 years long, after 2 years, your textbook's out of date.
Yep.
Right? And, you know, we've got to prepare children for the prospect of learning stuff and unlearning stuff. And one of the biggest difficulties in teaching and the most dangerous things to hear in teaching is, I've always done it this way. Mm. You know, well, you know, if I go to Wordsworth classroom in the Lake District in Hawkshead, there's about 10 desks all facing the front with a blackboard at the front. And we're still using that model today. I know we've said this before, but what happened, what, you know, if you go to a doctor, if you go to have an operation on your broken leg, would you like doctors using technology from 1746? No, you would not. So we've got to prepare children for the future because they're going to use technology. Mm. In fact, how many mobile phones do you collect when you come in? The second thing is, when we gave out the technology, there were problems. You know, there were kids using them inappropriately. Mm. There were kids, there were children who didn't understand the restrictions of using them. You know, there was some very small percentage of children who were using it to contact other children inappropriately. Mm. And, you know, there was a lot of, well, you've got to stop this. Well, we can't have these, devices going home. It's got to, you know, we had a bit of that around. And I said, whoa, hang on. This is a world in which 2.5 billion, in 1994, there were 1 million users of the internet. Now, there are 3 billion. These children are going to grow up with it. They need to use it to learn it properly, and they've got to learn to use technology properly. But technology is only a tool to demonstrate learning. The bit that the government missed out of technology curriculum was the communication bit. Technology is a form of communication, and it's a form of developing your thinking. If you're doing a presentation, Phil, do you write it on straight to technology or do you write it out first?
Usually write it out first.
Yeah. So there's a thought process.
Yeah.
You're using the technology to communicate that presentation to other people. Mm. Can be in a variety of ways, can't it? Mm. So technology is only a tool to demonstrate learning. If you're not demonstrating that, what are you using it for? Secondly, with that technology, in the future is going to come a whole host of dangers. Okay. Children more and more need to question the information they're getting in a society from a range of sources, including some governments that, you know, might alter things with Sharpie pens. But children need to be prepared to question the validity of that information and how it checks with other information, and use technology appropriately and positively to have an impact. The third thing is, technology is a tool which allows children to develop their communication skills. Children only truly understand a concept and an idea when they can communicate that idea to somebody else. And can explain their thinking. So there's lots of written ways of explaining thinking and oral ways of explaining thinking. And the technology provides a medium to do that. Mm. We also do lots of coding.
Yes.
Which is basically taking a big problem and breaking it down into much smaller problems. Mm. Let me give you an example. So you might say to kids, your children at home, go and brush your teeth. What you don't say is, get hold of the toothbrush. Take the lid off the toothbrush, off the toothpaste. Get your toothbrush. Put a pea-sized bit of toothpaste onto your brush. Put the toothbrush into your mouth. Move it up and down vigorously for a period of at least 2 minutes, etc. You just say, go and brush your teeth. Mm. Well, coding actually makes you think of all those tiny little steps. Mm. So if you take all those skills of learning, if you're faced with a math problem, what do you have to do? What are the lessons that aren't as effective are where teachers don't give children a problem and don't identify all the steps that go into, or the layers of understanding that go into that, solving that problem.
It's so interesting, that the whole technology thing. So you mentioned about, you know, preparing them for jobs and classrooms that are set up in traditional ways. And I can almost feel the sort of Twitter sphere now moving into it, saying, he's advocating 21st century skills for jobs that don't exist. And a lot of the research movement are quite against that, in terms of that they like more traditional approaches, teacher at the front. with knowledge. But actually, there's got to be somewhere the Goldilocks principle of, you know, a little bit of this and it just right. So, I mean, I think about the way that you've used technology is a really good example of that, because what's put me off, and it still puts me off, Jonathan, if I'm honest, and I probably shouldn't say this on a podcast, it just, in the schools when I, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And I think, oh, I come in with Apple TV, I come in with an iPad, I want to use the iPad as a visualizer, because everyone's got one of those now. I want to use it as the board, because I can use that. I want to use it to record homeworks. I want to record pupils' work at a very quick thing. I want to use it a demonstration for practical work, because I teach science. I can use it for all those things, if it works. But the number of times I plug it in, and it says HDMI missing or no signal. But what I like about the way you've set it up is you really thought carefully about making sure that everything is seamless. So when I come here and do conferences and things, it's a case of flick it on, whatever classroom it is, AirPlay, and it works. And when it works, and when it's implemented properly, it's really, really effective in terms of you can gauge the reaction of all of those pupils at any time in those lessons through the apps that you've chosen and through the fact that they can project their work directly onto a board.
I'll tell you why it works. And that was in those first 4 years when we were focusing on what to teach and diagnosing stuff and getting information from children and the skills of teaching. In the meantime, in my head, and then, you know, I was selling a vision to governors as I want a device per child in 8 years' time. So what do we need to do to get there? Well, we upgraded the server.
Yeah.
We upgraded the Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
We started investing in small numbers of devices that worked. Mm. Repetitively, because as soon as it doesn't work, teachers get, I'm not doing it again.
Mm.
So it's got to work. There's no question. So we upgraded all the infrastructure in school. Mm. We have a dedicated internet line, because if you're going to have 700 devices in a school, you need a much more internet.
Yeah.
Okay, because of the 10 meg line. So that took three years to do, upgrade all that infrastructure. So no technology really was introduced until all that behind-the-scenes stuff was going to work, so that you just plugged it in and it worked.
Mm.
And then when you start introducing it, once you've done this, once you've done that, and you've invested in all of that, and you plug it in and it works, and teachers then begin to use it. And obviously there are people perhaps of who are less willing to use technology, but when we do invest heavily in it, every teacher gets an iPad Pro, so that, you know, it's non-negotiable here.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to learn to use technology. Every child gets an iPad, all right? So you've got to be able to use it effectively, because, you know, that change is mandatory, growth is optional type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about the not doing the traditional stuff, because we do a lot of work on the traditional stuff as well. If you go back to Rosenshine, I would say that lots of that is he's saying lots of questions and lots of responses to check for understanding. Now that's a method I would use going into a class. If I was going to teach a class, I would use that, because I need to work out where that class is before I actually teach the right thing.
Yeah.
So the lots of Rosenshine stuff is actually what you call traditional instructional teaching, and Dylan Williams advocated different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're both saying, if you marry the two up, and you can marry the two up, is I am getting information from children.
Yeah.
They're just always, and all are appropriate. Mm-hmm. And if you ask a child to stand at the front and ask questions based upon what they're doing, or to question the class, or to give a presentation, then you're assessing their understanding. And if they're questioning, you can stand there at the side, because they're doing the questioning, because you've taught them to ask the right questions, and you can assess the class, and you can interject. Your then job then becomes to interject with the right question, as opposed to asking loads of them. So there's space for all of those techniques, and one, because you're advocate of one, just preempted, doesn't mean you don't have to be an advocate of another. The fact is, they all work. They don't all work all the time.
Mm.
They all work some of the time. And your job as a teacher, if you're assessing your children well enough and you're giving them feedback, that actually you get better. You never get it perfect, but you get better at identifying which techniques can be used in which circumstance. And that's your job. And you're going to get it wrong every day.
Mm.
You're going to make mistakes every day, and you're going to use the wrong techniques every day.
Mm.
But here's the good news. If you're a teacher, you get 5 hours a day to practice.
Mm.
So you get 25 hours a week to practice. So if I was playing the piano for 25 hours a week, that would not make me brilliant, but it would make me a lot better.
Mm.
And occasionally I then went to a staff meeting where there was a piano recital, so I could see how it was done properly.
Yeah.
And then there's the inset day,
yeah.
where I spend the whole day listening to the piano,
yeah.
you know, in different styles. but then I have to go and practice myself. So what the question I have for teachers is, what are you practicing right now? In your classroom, what are you practicing? What are you trying to get better at? Is it going to have an impact on the students or the children? And what impact is it going to have if it is going to have an impact? How do you know what to practice? What research are you doing? How are you marrying that with what you already know? Those types of conversations.
No, it's brilliant. I mean, I'm reading at the minute Matthew Sage. Have you seen some of his work? So he's got a new one.
Black Box Thinking, was it?
Yeah. So he's got a new one called Rebel. I think it's called Rebel Thing or Rebel Ideas. I'll correct it in the show notes. But he's talking about the kind of things that maybe I've tried to do with this podcast, which is escape your points of reference and look outside a little bit further. Yeah. So some of the discussions around should you do this have become quite dogmatic in terms of you need to do this. Now, I understand that in terms of research and evidence-based practice, you want people to use the best available evidence. But I think this is obviously an extra to all the jobs that I'm doing. You want to look outside of your points of reference because I can only see things in terms of secondary, really, because that's my frame of reference, middle-aged, you know, slightly overweight.
No, you're younger than that.
These are my points of reference, and I need to get outside of that, and that's what we've tried to do in terms of the podcast, is look a little bit wider about what other people are doing. And I think that the way that you've used technology has been, you know, an example to other people, not just in terms of technology, but the implementation, and that's where the research does come in. The way that you've implemented things and, you know, seen, they look easy from the outside, but the work that's gone into that beforehand has really been big. Leading on from that, so all of these things have led to massive year-on-year increases in terms of outcomes for pupils, which is, you know, the reason that we all get up in the morning and go to work.
Yeah.
So much so that it's been identified, later identified as kind of an example for sort of national people that are talking about this. So in terms of your link with Teacher Toolkit and Ross, how did that come about? And if you can remember, what exactly do you talk about in terms of the case study on Leighton in that Just Great Teaching book?
I mean, I think the connection with Ross just came through Twitter. We've been using the 5-minute lesson plan for, you know, I've never collected a lesson plan in my life as a head teacher. So, you know, I thought everybody, you know, when I started, I thought everybody else was doing it right and I wasn't. Was doing it, you know. There's no head teacher manual when you become a head teacher, right? You know. So I've never collected a lesson plan in my life because I'm not really interested in reading about what you're doing. I want to know what you're actually doing. So instead of collecting lesson plans, I walk in a classroom. But I found some of our less experienced teachers were used to writing, you know, they go to college and they're used to writing reams and reams for every lesson. So we started using Teacher Toolkit resources. You know, 5-minute lesson plan, pretty good idea as to basically the what once you've discussed the why.
Yeah.
And as you know, Claire, our deputy, is vastly au fait and a member of the Twitterati.
She does
get into contact with a wide range of people. So yeah. I think, you know, Claire sort of said to Teacher Toolkit, we'll come up and sort of, what, you know, these are the type of things we're doing.
Yeah.
And then he got in touch with us and we had a conversation and he seemed to think some of the things we were saying was interesting enough to put into his book.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's how, what did we talk about? Well, the most of what we talked about is exactly what we've talked about.
Yeah.
And really it's about the feedback you give pupils and all of that is an extension of it. So the dialogical teaching, the use of technology, we tend to mark some things in books, but some things via ICT. So let me give you an example, if I can. Most literary marking for literacy is done via ICT. Okay. So the educational reasons for this is we want it to be a two-way process. We want children not to fix up work, but to develop their ability. Because most of the time, if you write a genre, you give 2 stars and a wish, and then the kids don't do that genre again for about 4 months.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a waste of time.
Mm.
Secondly, I don't want to do anything for Ofsted or anything to be seen. I don't want to, you know, collect books and have a list of things to see. So our feedback policy is now 4 pictures. That's it. All right. The bottom line is, you do what works. If it's not working, you're doing the wrong thing. If it is working, you do, and kids are getting better at learning more stuff, then it's the right thing. So what we do is the teacher has an app and the children take a photo of their work with their app and upload it to the teacher's app. I won't give it a shameless plug, but...
Oh, please do. I mean, right. It's fine. It's
Shelby. So Shelby is... But Shelby is an app where you can take a picture and then you can give feedback. So, but the key isn't the app. is what I'm trying to say, because people say, oh, well, you shall be, and that's great. Oh, hang on. Bear in mind, we've done 4 years on the right type of feedback and looking at the research in that.
Yeah.
We've done lots on growth mindset. We've then done dialogical teaching, which builds resilience amongst kids to all the time be getting feedback that that's good, now do this. That's good, now do this. All came from years ago, ego-focused feedback is not a good thing to do, and task-focused feedback is a better thing to do. Yeah. Well, if that's the thing to do, task-focused feedback, how can we get really good at that?
Mm.
You know, because, you know, two stars and a wish is task-focused feedback, but is it the right task-focused feedback? Well, let's have a look at what the right task. So you go into depth in that. So once you've done all that, then when you get Shelby, two stars and a wish, if you're still giving voice feedback on two stars and a wish, it's just as bad as if you were doing it.
Yeah.
Or in effect. Or it does have an effect, but there are other things that are more effective, I suppose I'll say. So, in terms of some of the stuff that I was talking to Ross about, it is about creating a two-way assessment process. So you uploaded it, teacher gives voice feedback and written feedback. So as the kids come in the morning, they've got an iPad. The teacher's downloaded your work to your iPad. On that piece of work is voice feedback, and you can talk a lot. We know about teachers, they can talk a lot.
Someone should do a jingle about talking to teachers. I don't know if anyone's thought of that.
If you're still listening to me at the, you know, anyone still listening to me now after I've talked this much, then you can guarantee that teachers like talking a lot, and I'm obviously living proof of it. But the child is then, the feedback is focused on what the child needs to learn in order to make their writing better. The child then responds to that, does whatever the child or the student needs to do. Then they upload it back to the teacher. So that your feedback doesn't become, you do work for me. And the other thing it does is that work can then be shared amongst all the children in the class. Now, another thing that teachers do is children have an audience of one, or students have an audience of one when they come to school. In secondary schools, they have an audience of nine. You've got that audience is your history teacher, and that's your literacy teacher. Yeah. In primary schools, it's one.
Mm.
Well, actually, that's a bit. You know, it's not ideal, is it? You know, because you tend to do what you think that person wants from you.
Mm.
What if you have a global audience? We've got 3 billion users of the internet.
Mm.
All right. Teachers love developing their audience by tweeting on Twitter.
Yeah.
Why do we not provide that opportunity for children enough? What about websites and so on and so forth, where you have an audience and invite loads of feedback on your work? Where if people actually really believe some of the things and are really into some of the feedback stuff that we're saying, that you can get task-focused feedback, not just task-focused feedback, but really quality task-focused feedback. That instead of, and the whole transference of, I am the teacher, my job is to make you better, actually, I am the student, my job is to get better. That's my responsibility. The teacher can help me. So can the child who's commented on my work on the internet.
Yep.
So can the person next door. So can the person in the table opposite. All these people can help me get better. So if I have a growth mindset mentality that I can always get better, and if that is prevalent in the school, then I want good feedback. Good teachers seek good feedback. Feedback that will improve me. I want to know what I'm not doing right. And so you're creating actually an ethos for learning that if we go back to talking about, you know, the jobs of the future and 14 jobs by the time you're 38 and all that kind of stuff, well, actually, what are the key skills of that? One is technology, but far more importantly, because the technology is going to change.
Yeah.
The technology is going to change. Kids are using the worst piece of kit they'll ever use, because it's going to get better.
Yeah.
But what's not going to change is the skills you need to adapt and actually the skills you need to get better. And the people who will get better are the ones who will succeed more, perhaps, in life. And therefore, what are the skills of seeking and the resilience and the reflectiveness and all that work Claxton did on learning?
Yep.
You need all that if you're going to get the best feedback and live with it.
Mm.
And teachers are terrible at this because what the teachers look at when you get your observation sheet, you did all these things well. I'm not interested in that. What do I need to work on?
Okay. It's the old school report analogy, isn't it?
It is.
You can get 9 A's and a B, but it's the B that's the one that... Sorry, I'm showing
you. You got 9 A's and a B.
I don't think I ever got 9 A's and a B, to be honest.
You were a lot better at school than I was.
Someone's going to scrutinize. Someone will do a freedom of information request, won't they, for my qualifications?
I did actually read one of my high school reports in geography the other night.
to cheer yourself up.
It was I think Class Clown was mentioned.
Right.
I think Doesn't Turn Up to Lessons was mentioned. And
I think, couldn't find his geography lesson.
Yeah. Has he been here has been mentioned. So I apologise to all any geography teachers who remain listening at this moment in time.
Right, I'm just conscious, because I say this every single time, but we always try to keep it down to around about commute length, because people seem, the audience seems to like the fact that they can listen
we
to
should
it.
Have cut me off about half an hour.
No, ago. Not at all, because you don't know how long people's commutes are, do you? So that's the thing, as long as it's reasonable commute time. I just wanted to finish by talking about your sort of outward-facing work. So this is part of that in terms of sharing what sort of stuff that is going on. But you do quite a lot in terms of raising the profile of Blackpool, publicising what kind of good work are going on across primaries and secondaries in Blackpool. So just talk a little bit about, you know, the Teach Meet that you held, which had record numbers last year, and record numbers of classroom teachers talking about their practice to other classroom teachers, and a little bit about all the stuff that you do with Apple in terms of the training events you provide for them.
We do quite a lot of work with Apple in terms of leadership and leadership of ICT. And they utilise the school in terms of, and they do actually really get it. They get that actually we're not here for devices. We're actually here to sell teaching and learning. As a result, we use some devices. They do understand that, but obviously they have a slightly different take on it. But it's really valuable, that work that we do. More valuable, I suppose, is actually the work we do on anybody who wants to listen, really. Yeah. Teach Meet is one of those things. That's the actual gathering and sharing of ideas, just as work yourself do in the research ed school. What it is getting people together from a wide range of backgrounds, from a wide range of experiences, and actually getting and giving other teachers the chance to promote stuff that works well in their setting and how they've worked in house. That's about the sharing of ideas. Well, actually, our challenge, if teacher efficacy has replaced, you know, understanding success criteria or whatever it was as Hattie's number one, then what are the best examples of teacher efficacy that we can actually provide?
Mm.
What does that mean? Because that's a broad range of terms. Mm. It's a broad analogy to say, well, it's people knowing the standards they're aiming for.
Yeah.
Well, what are the standards people are aiming for? Because I bet they're different in every year 5, every year 6, every year 7, every year 8.
Mm.
What are the standards that we're aiming for?
Mm.
And why do we lower those standards in some settings than others?
Mm.
For example, I read in the summer holidays that the new GCSEs that state schools pupils have to undertake are harder than the international schools that public school students have to undertake in many ways. So why aren't we creating a level playing field? If Blackpool is going to escape from all those things that people, you know, the statistics we know, most deprived seaside town in the country, you know, highest rate of unemployment, lowest average wage, but when I see children, I don't see children who can escape that.
Mm.
I see children have the potential to escape that.
Mm.
So are we doing that? Are we actually changing the demographic? Our bottom line is, are we changing what Blackpool becomes? And sure, that's all our aim. And I have a vision. It's why I've stayed in Blackpool for 22 years. Got a real passion for that. I think these kids are as can do as well as anybody in the country.
Yeah.
They certainly, as children, when you talk to year sixes, they want to be lawyers.
Mm.
They want to be doctors.
Mm.
They want, but do you know what they say? I'm not going to be able to do that here. I need to move.
Mm.
So their aspirations are just as, you know, no 11-year-old will sit and say, I don't want to do anything. I want to be unemployed.
Yeah.
They all want to do something and they want to contribute to society. And the children leave here, our value added this year is 5.4 in reading. 5.4 in maths, 4.5 in reading and 3 in writing. So, and these children are leaving by and large with like 90-odd% national average, 60%, 50-60% above expected in and 30% in writing. So if children are getting those results, which are as good as any school in the country, and we don't think we just think we're teaching quite well and doing, why can't they then move on to do great things? Why can't they move on to get 9 eights and nines and sevens, eights and nines at GCSE? Mm. Why can't they then go to university? Where's Blackpool's university? Mm. You know, how do we value education? How do we actually develop children who can go on and do things and stop them going to London or Manchester or somewhere where they can actually make the most of their potential, because every human has huge amounts of potential. Mm. I always take offence at the phrase in schools. Don't know why I take offence of it, but it's just a personal thing. We aim to get children to reach their full potential. Mm. Well, 80% of people go to the grave having fulfilled 20% of their potential. Mm. How do you know what people's potential is? You don't. Mm. What you do is teach them to be really good learners. Mm. And they'll learn to develop with a little guidance and help and belief. Children are, when I first started that biological teaching, I thought, oh, I wonder if our kids will be able to do this. Yeah. I wonder if they'll be able to stand up there and talk and question. I'm not sure they can. Yeah. I was blown away.
Yeah.
Just exceeded. I changed my expectations to what students could do after I saw it done really well. And it was our teachers who did it brilliantly. Yeah. They learned how to do it really, really well. And I was like, wow, our kids can do it. I've been holding them back for 18 years by not giving them the opportunity to do this.
Yeah.
And here's me, you know, our standards are really high, we're doing this. Mm. And I'm looking at these kids saying, I've been asking enough of them.
Mm. For me, in terms of the staff as well, you mentioned about how well schools in Blackpool are doing, you know, to kind of make progress for pupils. But in terms of the staff, the number of teachers that give, you know, extra time to come to teach meets.
Absolutely.
The amount of, and the culture within the town of sharing this best practice across.
And how many did you have on a Saturday?
Well, I mean, I said this in the shameless plug section part of the podcast, but it was just to, I think, you know, a controversial statement now, but I did say this at Research Ed National last week and nobody's corrected me yet, so Tom Bennett may well be aware of this. But I think Blackpool stands to be the second biggest research event, and I'm not talking in the country, we're talking across the world in terms of how many people are going. So we sold 500 for March at the moment. So, you know, we haven't really publicised it too much.
So that demonstrates massively the desire for people to give up their own time to do it.
Yeah.
People want to get better. They want to listen to other people. And they're also accepting much, much more that there isn't one way. You know, the strategies came out, the curriculum came out, there's one way of doing this. Yeah. No, there isn't. In my early part of my career, I was certainly at leadership level, I was guilty of going into classrooms and watching teachers and saying, but you just need to do this. And what I was actually saying without saying it was, well, you need to be a bit more like me, don't you? And what I've learned over time to realise is, no, you don't need to be a bit more like me. These are the principles of really good teaching.
Yeah.
Go away and practice them. This is the principles of really good feedback. Go away and practice them. These are some people who do this really well. These are some people who do that really well. And as you know, there's a watch me culture that we developed here for a while, which is everyone can sign up and you can come and watch me. Yeah. So I remember delivering a maths lesson with 13 people, more adults than students. Mm. As a teacher, so I said, no, give me feedback, and they gave me some feedback. Mm. So then that leaves people a little bit more open to receiving feedback. Yeah. And just a tiny little contribution to all sorts of other things, but that. And it's seeping. It's not just Blackpool people who come to research Ed and those teach meets, is it? It's people from Lancashire as well and from beyond. And a variety of presenters. But a skill, if we come back to the skill, is in explaining your thinking is a key element of understanding it yourself.
Mm.
Then it's giving teachers the opportunities to demonstrate and justify and explain what they do. Mm. And it's creating a critical thinking mass within the teaching profession. Mm. So instead of, here's a scheme, I deliver it, why am I delivering that?
Yeah.
What am I doing that for? Is that having an impact? Do I assess, you know, that thing you mentioned earlier, will I do a unit then I assess at the end? Mm. I say, no, your formative assessment is the far most important. Mm. The summative assessment is when it becomes a noun.
Mm-hmm.
An assessment's not a noun, it's a verb.
Yeah. I mean, just last bit on the conference, but what I liked about when you do the digital technologies launches and all the conferences that you do here, it's not always you or Claire or the senior leadership team of the school that does this. You know, it was very much your teachers that were leading on that, and that was really appreciated by people that were here, because they are the people that are doing this day in, day out.
That's really important, because actually the test of a vision is to whether, if you're a head teacher, the test of a vision is to whether your staff can expound it.
Yeah.
So the least I can talk, And the more they can talk, the better for everybody, really.
Yeah.
Because it's the it's a test. And actually, I suppose when you become a head teacher, your class become the staff as opposed to the children.
Yeah.
And it's just like when you see, you know, your staff do well, it's just like seeing your class do really well. Mm. And Jim Collins, if I can recommend any book on leadership.
Good to great.
Good to great.
Yeah.
What does he say about leadership? I've just used this quote this morning.
Yeah.
He says, that, and politicians take note, if there's any listening. You can achieve, especially as, you know, seem to be a little few egos around at the moment.
One or two.
You can achieve anything if you take the ego out of it.
Mm.
The role of a head teacher for me is to create the conditions under which excellence can thrive. Okay? And then you take yourself out of it and let everybody take the credit.
Mm.
If politicians did the same, then we'd have a better world, because no politician ever taught a lesson.
Mm.
But they want to take credit when standards rise. No politician ever performed an operation, but they want to take credit when waiting lists come down.
Mm.
And their ego gets in the way of actually making the right decisions, because they're going to have to be re-elected into however many years, and they want the credit for it.
Yeah.
Take the ego out of it, take the credit out of it, and you will find that you can achieve more success. Your job, you can't teach, there's 21 classes in the school.
Mm.
You can't teach every lesson.
No.
So the idea is in creating the conditions and the climate through which teachers can question. Because you're a learning community, and that's everybody. It's not just, it's everybody, isn't it?
Mm.
Including the head teacher, who is the lead learner. I believe that this you know, the title adopted by someone very close to you.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Who hasn't been on the podcast yet.
Has he not?
No, he hasn't. And I do believe, and I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm sure he'll be okay. I believe he's signed up to do somebody else's podcast, which is quite an interesting thing. Has so, he? Yeah. Yeah, but I'm sure that public shaming now will embarrass him into having to
good.
Do it.
But when someone, I went on a course when I became a head teacher.
Mm.
You know, you go on a course. And,
yeah.
And when the staff know when you're a new head teacher, you've been on a course, you can come back. You have a staff meeting.
Yes.
And all the staff are sat around saying, they've been on a course. So I went on a course and it said, head teachers are the lead learner in the school.
Mm.
And I was, what? What does this mean? What does this look like? What does it mean I'm a lead learner? What do I have to learn? Well, of course, at that time, on my first day of headship, I rung up my friend who became a head teacher on the same day, and we said, what do we do? How do we do this job?
Yeah.
What do head teachers actually do? Because I was a teaching deputy. I taught 4.5 days a week.
Yeah.
I was allowed out for half a day and in that half a day, I looked after maths, assessment, ICT, and CPD.
Mm.
Okay. And then I have to go back to check the PPA teacher was okay. Alright, so I got half an hour away. So when I became head teacher, I had no idea what the job was about.
Mm.
And some may say that this is still the case.
Well, we'll pause there, because we can leave this open for a second, a return visit, Jonathan, to discuss headship. Last little bit, I know you get a lot of visitors already, lots of people want to come and see you later and see what kind of things you're doing here, and I think that's only going to increase with the publicity in terms of results and the feature in the book that we talked about. So if people are interested in that, what would you suggest that they do? How can they get in touch? What kind of avenues have they got for that?
You can Jonathan6671 on Twitter, or Claire, our deputy, is very eager and gets a lot of requests over Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can email me at the school, and those email addresses are on the school website. Probably the easiest place to get through to us is just by a message on Twitter, you know. And we've hosted at least 17 visits last year for maths work, you know, several more for some of the literacy work we do. And we learn as much from other people as they do from us. So, and if we are going to become a collaborative led profession, which is what the best, you know, for me, the best thinking is to schools should be judged on their ability to collaborate, not necessarily lots of other things and the work we're doing in that regard, as your good self.
We're trying.
But that work is really valuable. That work is really valuable, because you're actually opening the profession's mind to saying there isn't one thing. So get in touch with us via Twitter.
Brilliant. Right, just remains to say thank you so much for your time today, and thanks for the first face-to-face. That was quite painless, wasn't it?
We've sat in this situation on several occasions.
We have. Usually without a microphone,
I'm really sorry I haven't made you coffee yet, so I'm going to do that once you finish recording.
Fantastic. Right, well, thanks again, Jonathan. Thanks for your time. Much appreciated.
You're welcome.
Just listening back to this podcast makes me realise and appreciate how lucky I am to work in a town with so many research-informed, amazing educators. Anyone who wants to see Jonathan and some of the Leighton staff speak more about the themes of this podcast can come along to Research Ed Blackpool. Moving into the shameless plug section. So, on the 12th of October, I'll be speaking at Lead Learn Lancs, which, if you're not aware of that, is a fantastic sold-out event that I enjoyed immensely last year. So if you are coming along, please come and say hello. However, following the release of the schedule, and with a little local knowledge from last year, I can see that I'm up against the legends of Lead Learn Lancs in the fantastic Session 1. So consequently, I don't think I'm going to attract too many people coming along to listen to me speak, which is fine, as it's a brilliant day and I'll enjoy listening to everybody else. However, to incentivize it some more, during my session, I'm thinking about giving away 2 tickets for Research Ed Blackpool. But don't let that affect your choices, listeners, he says, cough, cough, wink, wink. Anyway, in further shameless plugs, I'm still awaiting the release of my much-awaited, well, by me at least, article for the Royal Society of Chemistry entitled Promotion, Is It Worth It? And I've been assured that that will land in this week. So in terms of next week's podcast, and I've just got a fantastic week's podcast recording to come. So I am speaking to Doug Lamorf tomorrow night about Reading Reconsidered and my ultimate favourite book, which of course everybody knows is Teach Like a Champion. I'll also be talking to Dame Alison Peacock on Wednesday about the work of the Chartered College and her career. And I've got a full recording schedule to take me right up to Christmas and beyond. So thank you for everybody that's involved in that. And thank you again, everybody who is listening and making it such a joy to do. In terms of the carpool for school that was promised for this week, I have not forgotten about that. However, we spoke for such a long time, and the boys will testify to that, that there's quite a lot of editing that needs doing. So with a full, well, at least full for the 3 days that I'm there, teaching timetable and everything else that goes with it, I'm sure you know about this, listeners, I'm going to put that one on the back burner just until half term, so I've got a little bit more time to do the edit properly. So next week, it'll either be Doug Lamorf or Alison Peacock that you'll be listening to on Nailers Natter. So once again, thank you for listening, and thank you for the Teacher Development Trust for their input and continued support. And I'll see you all again, same time, next week.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.